One of the big things that's kind of going on right now, you're probably aware of this, are any of y'all involved in this, these deals of reading through the Bible in a year? Yeah. No. Okay. Wrong audience. Okay. I know the Munger Church is involved in that, but there's kind of a big deal now about kind of just kind of looking at the Bible. So we're going to take the next year to kind of be focusing on big biblical material. The biggest part of the year is going to be looking at two sections of the Bible, which are sort of the standard go-tos for Christian living and Jewish living. Have you ever heard the Ten Commandments? You may not know anything else about the Old Testament. You know Moses, and you know the Ten Commandments. And then the New Testament, what would be the New Testament equivalent? Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus interprets the Ten Commandments. So, for the next year, we're going to be doing some exploring of the more influential parts of the Bible. We'll do the Ten Commandments and Sermon on the Mount. Each of those will probably be 3 or 4 months each. So it'll be the better part of the year. But before that, I thought it might be kind of fun to take a look, kind of, you know, pull out Bible big picture. Because let's face it, the Bible can be, now I realize some of us can teach this material, but for a lot of people, the Bible can be kind of intimidating. If you remember back in August and September, we spent 6 weeks exploring the Bible in a different kind of way. We talked about how it is that we got the Bible. Now do you remember? Some of you weren't here then. Okay, that's all right. Yeah. But the idea was about the Bible as a whole. How did we get it? How did we have the Bible we have? Two things. How do we have the books that are in the Bible? So we talked about the process of canonization of these books versus those books. We also talked about the manuscripts, which is from where we actually get the actual words that are in our Bible. Took a look at that. We even looked at how the story, how it is that we lost. That's embarrassing. How do you lose part of the Bible? But we did back in 1699 when it was decided that within the Protestant tradition, we were going to no longer use some of the books that Christians had used, you know, for 1600 years. And then we ended with the inspiration, authority, interpretation. That was sort of about the Bible as a whole. We're going to go back and revisit now, not that material, but we're going to go back to the Bible as a whole. And we're just going to do kind of a follow-up. And the focus here is different. What we want to do now is to look at what's actually in the Bible. What is the content? And it's a fairly hefty book, isn't it? There's a lot of material there. You know, it, even without notes, it runs several thousand pages. So our goal over the next, we have 4 lessons over 5 weeks because Paul's going to take 3 weeks from today. Paul will be taking all the venues to do some special announcements. But 4 weeks to give you a basic introduction overview of the content of what is in the Bible. We'll be talking about some degree about the differences between the Jewish Bible, the Protestant Bible and the Catholic Bible. So our focus is big picture. How is it organized? So we'll do that when we talk about the Old Testament. We'll talk about the New Testament. It is actually an organized document. Things are put in there in a particular order for a particular reason. Then we want to look at the grand sweep of the narrative. You probably know that starting with Genesis 1:1, there is a pretty much historical narrative story. And it's going to go down to roughly about 4 centuries before Jesus. And the Bible is sort of organized chronologically. Even the non-historical books are kind of organized within that grand sweep. And then we want to look at just a little bit about each of the books that are in the Bible. A lot of times, as we're telling the story, we'll be saying that this is like from Kings or Chronicles or whatever. But also, sometimes there are other books like Prophets that fit into a particular historical narrative and try to weave those in. And then, of course, there's some of the books are called writings. So we're going to take 2 weeks to cover the New Testament. I know it can be done because we did it last Wednesday night, okay? And if you divide that time in half, we should be okay. Then Paul Rasmussen is going to speak to all venues, 28th. We will have kerygma. We will have the sacred and holy coffee and donuts. And but Paul will be up here on the screen talking to all the venues. And then we'll take the first 2 weeks in February to cover the New Testament. Sound like a plan? So, after going really, really, really deep with Luther, this is not that kind of heavy stuff. It's broad strokes, but again, for some of us, it's going to be reviewed. For some of us, well, we might, you know, it's possible. There's some of this you may not have seen before. So, beginning with the Old Testament, it is roughly, by word count, approximately 80% of the Protestant Bible. Anybody here raised Catholic? You had an extra, how many, 12, 14 books of the Old Testament. So in the Catholic Bible, the Old Testament's actually closer to 90% of the Bible. So it's substantial. It's the bulk of the Bible. It contains 39, and this is the Protestant Bible, of the 66 books that are in our Bible. It's written over a 1,000-year period. It is written in three different languages. Anybody know what they are? Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic. Okay, Aramaic being basically Assyrian Persian, and it looks a lot. By the way, the letters that you see today, the Hebrew, that's Aramaic. Those are the Aramaic letters and stuff. Paleo-Hebrew looks like chicken scratch. It's interesting to see that. It's numerous authors, some of which we know by name. Can you think of one? Moses. You know, traditionally, Moses gets the first five books of the Bible. Can you think of Psalms of? Okay. Proverbs of? Solomon. Yeah, and on. A lot of the authors we don't know. Who wrote the Deuteronomic history? We don't know. The book of Psalms attributes Psalms to at least 15 people in there. So, variety of locations, variety of cultures. And the most recent material in there is 2,000 years old. So, from another time, another place, another culture. So, this is what we want to look at. So, here's the structure of the Old Testament. Again, maybe you covered this in Sunday school, maybe you did not. We got 39 books in our Bible. We'll talk a little bit later, just a slide, one side of the Apocrypha. It's organized into roughly three parts, the law, the prophets, and the writings. Does that sound familiar? Okay. That can be within the Jewish tradition, within the Christian tradition. So you've got the law, prophets, and the writings. It's basically historical. Where would the earliest point in time be? Genesis. Where would the last point in time be? Roughly, Malachi, yeah. Daniel probably is actually written later, but there's a flow to it. The law also has other names. It's known as the Torah. And law is interesting because in Hebrew, Torah actually means instruction or teaching. So, for example, in the law, do you have stuff that's not legal? Like Genesis 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yeah, and stuff like that. The story of the Exodus. So it's combined material. It's also called the Pentateuch. Familiar with that? Five books. The law narrates the story of God's people from creation down to the Exodus, roughly dated, you know, don't get hung up on a particular year, but ballpark around 1200 BCE, that era. Now the prophets, there's actually two bodies of material that are distinctly different. You can see some on the left, some on the right. It is all historical in nature, although there's a lot of poetry and other things in there too, but it's, you know, basically it's set within historical time frames. It is arranged roughly, again, chronologically. Some of them not quite as much, but closely. The prophets continue the story of God's people for approximately another 800 years after the Exodus. That's actually technically wrong. That's actually 600 years because Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah actually takes it down to another 800, and Ezra and Nehemiah is actually a different body of material. So from the period of the Exodus up to 40 years before Jesus, are actually with this material that's in red to the Babylonian exile. Prophets divide into two groups. You heard of the former prophets and the latter prophets? Anybody remember that from Sunday school? Some people not taught that. Some were, you know, kind of. The former prophets are Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Are those prophets? They're not. On the right-hand side, if you got Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, those are prophets, right? So the prophets involve two types of material. The six books as the former prophets are historical in nature. They sort of continue the story. And they're going to continue it for another 600 years. And by the way, why do we call them prophets? Well, in those books, have you ever heard of people like Elijah, Elisha, Nathan? There are prophets in those. So it's called former prophets because there are prophets woven within those. So from the time of the Exodus, about 1200 BC, down to the Babylonian exile, 597, 586 is the two times there. Again, because they include stories of prophets. And there's others in there too, Micaiah and some others. Scholars refer to them as the Deuteronomic history. Have you heard that term? Okay, that may be new for us. The former prophets, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, are referred to as the Deuteronomic history. for a particular reason. Their theology is essentially identical to that of Deuteronomy. And it appears that whoever produced the book of Deuteronomy also produced these. So, for example, you will find in these six books plus Deuteronomy this: if you obey the Lord your God, what happens? All is well. Live long, prosper in the land. If you do not obey the Lord your God, not so good. Okay. So if you suffer, it must be because you disobeyed and sinned. And if you want to get right with God, you need to obey. Okay. That's Deuteronomic theology. Okay. It's found in these books. It's not found in Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and others. And it really kind of goes back to Jeremiah. Okay. It's a sort of a prophetic strand. Together, the five books of the Torah, the six books of the former prophets, give a coherent story, a coherent narrative from creation up through about four centuries before Jesus, or six here, but when we throw Chronicles in, we'll go ahead. Old Testament contains I don't know how many decades I lived, I never knew there was two histories in the Old Testament. I got cheated in Sunday school, I think. Okay. They're two, and they're different, by the way. And they somewhat contradict each other. Not in terms of historical facts, but in terms of their approach. The Chronicler includes only four books. First and Second Chronicles, from which it gets its name, and Ezra and Nehemiah, which are obviously written from the same theology, same language, same kind of everything. It's a coherent story. Chronicles 1 starts where, would you think? Genesis 1:1. And then we get through the Pentateuch like in four verses, real quick. But then it kind of slows down and covers those. The Chronicler, and by the way, in the Jewish Bible course, 1 and 2 Chronicles is one book, Ezra and Nehemiah is one book. The Chronicler has a different approach to things. For example, in the temple, the Chronicler thinks the temple is the best thing that ever happened. Next to kings. The kings are the best thing that ever happened. The Chronicler loves kings. They're all of God and they're all holy. And we love the temple. It's the only place that God is. And then you refer over to the Deuteronomic history and you get a different view. In the Deuteronomic history, we have stories of, God is your king. So if you choose to ask for a king, which we have in what book? Samuel. Then you're rejecting who is a king. And that's not good. Okay. And we have, so which one of the Chronicler or Deuteronomic? And we same thing with kings. The Deuteronomic kings are all good, wonderful. That's Chronicle. Deuteronomic kings are not such necessarily a good idea. Which one do you think would have the story of David and Bathsheba? Deuteronomic, okay. Where David's very human, very kind of flawed, and same thing there. So, also with suffering. Remember the Deuteronomic theology of suffering? Chronicler rejects it, as does Job, as does Ecclesiastes, okay. But what's interesting about the Chronicler is, because it includes Ezra and Nehemiah, it continues the story another 200 years after Deuteronomy stops. So the Deuteronomic history stops with they're all punished, they're all hauled into Babylon. Well, what happens after that? Well, Deuteronomic history, you don't know. The Chronicler and Ezra and Nehemiah, we hear what happens, and they come back, and they rebuild the temple, and we're told in the book of Deuteronomy they've got the law, and they've got the synagogue, and all that kind of wonderful information. And we take it down to about four centuries before Jesus. Books of Ruth and Esther are short stories. They're not history in the sense of that we think of history. These are basically short stories meant to communicate a point, and they're set within the historical narrative. Between this week and next week, we'll actually look at the content of those. And then the first half of Daniel is a collection of short stories. You remember any of them? Who knows a story from Daniel? The Lion's Den. How about the three kiddos and the fiery furnace? That's not a story about Daniel. No, Daniel's not in that story. It's a collection of stories about what it's like to live in a land where the culture is against your faith. And how do you struggle with that? But it's placed there. Second half of Daniel, is an apocalypse. And it is the primary source of material for the book of Revelation and the New Testament. Revelation will quote more from Daniel than from any other book. Quotes from others, but there. And it's the only apocalypse in the Old Testament. By the way, Daniel is considered to be likely, as far as we know, the first apocalypse ever written in history. period, anywhere. It's that and Enoch. And Enoch's not in our Bible. Enoch is in the Ethiopian Bible, but not in ours. But it's very, very ancient. In our Bible, Ruth, Esther, and Daniel are included in the historical writings, sort of just kind of woven in with the former prophets, and then the Daniel and the latter prophets. But in the Jewish Bible, these three books are not considered to be prophets. They're considered to be writings. Same material. They're just named different because that's what they are. They're really writings. The latter prophets are 16 or 15 books. Here's the kicker. Is Daniel a book of prophecy or is it a writing? If you include it as a prophet, you've got 16. If you think of it as a writing, you've got 15. But it's a good number of books in the Old Testament. They all have the names of specific human beings, specific prophets, and they include material from the ministries of these prophets. So, for example, if you're looking at the book of Micah, you're going to find narrative or stories about Micah, and you're going to find things that Micah said, prophecies that Micah gave. These books supplement the history in the form of prophets. For example, if you want to know about Isaiah, you're going to read the narrative in Kings, and then you flip over to the book of Isaiah and get a lot more material. So that they're complementary in many of these cases. Same thing is true with, for example, Jeremiah. Supplement it, give me more details. All of these here, from Isaiah down, are set in the latter time period. The first prophets are going to appear around the year 150. That's going to be Amos, Hosea, Micah, and Amos, Hosea, Micah, and Isaiah. And they're going to go down to Malachi kind of at the end, over several hundred years. Later prophets, divided into two subgroups. You heard this, major and minor. When I first heard that, I thought, well, the major ones must be more important. Well, they kind of are, because if you think about it, the major prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Pretty significant. But Hosea and Amos and Micah, they're hugely influential. They're minor because why? Shorter. Yeah. Just has to do with the size of the book. Minor prophets, 12 shorter books. And the Jewish scriptures, they're so short, they weren't worth a scroll. So they put them all in one scroll. It was called the Book of the 12. Okay, and that's still true in the Jewish tradition. Jewish scriptures also combined 1 and 2 Samuel. They don't have a 1 and 2 Samuel. They have a book of Samuel. They have a book of Kings, and they have a book of Chronicles, and they have Ezra and Nehemiah as a combined book. So that gives you funky math. It's the same 39 books we have, but they count 24. Because 12 becomes 1, 2 become 1, 2 become 1, 2 become 1, 2 become 1. Same thing. By the way, our Old Testament and the Jewish Hebrew scriptures are identical in terms of content. They're organized slightly different, but in terms of content. Same material. The writings, then, are kind of what's left. 13 books in the Jewish Bible, 5 books in the Christian Bible, and the difference really comes down to, in the Jewish Bible, Ruth, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Lamentations, Daniel are counted as writings, and the Christian Bible, we count them as part of the former prophets, prophetic material, historical material. So in the Christian Bible, we really only have 5 writings, and they're all, for us, wisdom writings. Writings are a wide variety of literature, history, poetry, short stories, wisdom, you name it. In addition, we spend a lot of time on this, but this is just a quick deal for those of you who weren't here. Some Christian Bibles have extra books. Catholic Bible has an extra 16, actually an extra 12, and then the Orthodox Church has a few more than that. The ones in black, Maccabees through Baruch, are in the Catholic Bible in addition to what's in the Protestant Bible. The Orthodox Bible has the 39 plus the black plus the red. And then if you want to do the Ethiopian Bible, add Jubilees and add Enoch on top of that. They got the best Bible. They got more stuff. Okay. All this material in the Apocrypha is written in that 400-year period between the closing of the traditional Jewish canon and the opening of the New Testament, so Old Testament, New Testament. Sometimes called the intertestamental period, the literature is referred to as Apocrypha. So who remembers what Apocrypha means? Final exam? Hidden? Kind of hidden books, yeah. and they were called into question. So, make sense? Big picture? Now, the narrative, we've got to take 2 weeks to do because we're limited on time. But today, we're just going to talk about the story. The Bible begins in English. The first four words in the Bible are? Yeah. Bible makes no attempt to prove God. Bible assumes God. Okay, in the beginning, God. And from there, we launch forward. God is the source of the universe, all that is within it. We do that in two stories. At one level, the Genesis 1:1 through 1:3 is one story, starting in 2:3. Starting in 2:4 is the second story. Two different creation stories. At one level, they're very different. For example, in Genesis 1, does anybody remember the order of the days? What's created the first day? What's created the sixth day? People. Okay. Humans are created last. In Genesis 2, God creates Adam, and then creates creatures, then creates Eve. So human beings are first or second. At a logical level, that just trips a breaker. You know, cannot be. Which Jewish rabbis say, that tells you that you shouldn't read the Bible that way. Okay. But at a deeper level, same message. It affirms the goodness of creation. The narrative goes on to tell the origin of humans. We are in both creation stories that were both part of the created order. Remember in Genesis 2, Adam's, remember what the word Adam means in Hebrew? Dirt ball. That's what my Hebrew professor taught me. Adam, dirt, dust. Remember that story? For dust you are and dust you shall return. Okay, it's a reminder, you're not God. You are a creature, okay? And both of the stories indicate that humans are unique in the creation. So we're part of the created order, made of the dust of the earth, unique. Genesis 1 says that we're made in Imago Dei, in the image of God. Genesis 2 says we have the breath of God breathed into us, and the man became a living being. Same point. Something of God is within us, two different images. They're placed in this wonderful garden. All your needs are met. We're called to trust God, where there are some boundaries. You may eat of what in the garden, do you remember? Everything except tree of knowledge of good and evil. And in Hebrew, knowledge implies experience. So we don't want you to experience evil. So there's one thing in the garden you should really stay away from, which makes that bush immediately what? Interesting. Ever tell a child, don't touch the stove? Ooh, hadn't thought about it until you mentioned it. But, you know, yeah. Human nature. An observation. We use free will. Free will is not philosophically laid out, but free will is assumed throughout the entire biblical narrative. To reject God's boundaries, as a result, we're cast out of the garden. We live, remember Steinbeck? East of Eden. Not where God would have us to be. Narrative then proceeds to tell the story of what happens to the descendants of Adam and Eve. It is an ugly story. Okay, it is a sad, tragic story. One son kills another, and generation after generation, things get progressively worse. And there's a wonderful symbolism here. Remember Methuselah? He lived a ripe age of 72, didn't he? 900 and something, yeah. It's not literal every one, but the further you get from Eden, the shorter the lifespan is. And you just see it kind of spiraling down. There's a beautiful symbolism there. We're given hints that indicate the Bible is not trying to explain everything. For example, Adam and Eve have Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel, not looking good for the future of the human race. Cain goes to Nod and marries his wife, which raises a very philosophical question. Where did Nod come from? So I tell the sixth graders, you want to know, where are the dinosaurs? They're in Nod, okay? It's just part of what the Bible doesn't try to explain everything. This stuff loops back in. We got a narrative, a story. Decline of Eden culminates in the story of Noah and the flood and this really tragic statement where God regrets having ever made human beings and decides to wipe creation 1.0 off the board and have creation 2.0. So the flood represents this reset of creation. God begins again with Noah and with his family and preserving as much of creation as we can on the ark. One element in this narrative that attempts to tie the story to God's people to the larger world It's something that I used to want to skip, but you actually need to pay attention to it. You remember all the genealogies? Anybody raised on the King James Bible? All the begats. Remember the begats? You have this long list of all these weird people that you've, some of whom you've heard of, some of whom you've never heard of. In Genesis 4, Genesis 5, Genesis 7. What the heck does that have to do with anything? Well, that ties the story of the people of God to the larger story of the human race. So it's critically important. Links it right in. This makes the story of Israel universal. It is international. It is cosmopolitan. It is not parochial. God does not choose God's people for their own benefit. God chooses God's people because God has a plan for the world. And this will become one of the major emphases in the Bible. And if you know your New Testament, was Jesus involved with including the outsider? Did Paul extend the faith into the larger world? And has that been a major theme in the Christian faith ever since then? And are we still struggling with that? Consult the news this week. Okay. We still struggle. That concludes what is called the prehistory. Genesis 1 through 11, scholars refer to as, yes. Yeah. Yeah. This was a polygamous society, and I don't remember the specifics that I have to go back and read about. There's those little one offers in there, and you just kind of go, okay. It's like when Enoch didn't die, Enoch walked, was no more, and he walked with God. Okay, so where is Enoch? And you just kind of wonder, kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. But as the story rolls forward, yes. Okay, which is?
Basically, the sons of God, plural, have come down the earth and made the females who they found were created giants.
Yeah, yeah, that's another weird one, yeah. And that narrative is picked up in the book of Enoch and developed, yeah. Divine beings come to earth, have sex with human women, and produce giants. That'll keep you awake in Sunday school. Okay, yeah, that'll work, okay. The prehistory means this. There's absolutely nothing in Genesis 1 through 11 we can link to anything historical in terms of a time or a date or anything. People looking for Noah's Ark, Mount Ararat, and they're still at it up there, by the way. I'm trying to figure out, if you found it, how would you know? Audiographed? Yeah? Autographed? Noah, you know? Or when would you date it? I mean, even if you found pieces of a ship on a mountain, how would you know, kind of thing? Anyway, just know that Abraham is the first thing we can actually kind of have some sense. The remainder of Genesis narrates the story of one family. Creation 3.0. Okay, did not go with Adam and Eve and their kin. By the way, did it go much better for Noah and his family? No. Read your Bible. It's not pretty, okay? God begins again with Abraham and his descendants. And the story narrates how God can work through four generations of this family. And this is like one of those little myths I like to pop here. You heard of the patriarchs? Wrong. Patriarchs and matriarchs, okay? If you will look at these four generations, the women drive the story. Particularly with Rebecca. Whose machinations are going on in the tent? Rebecca? Yeah, what son does she like? Jacob. Which son is she operating against? And who does she manipulate? Isaac, her husband, yeah. And they even have Aseneth, who's actually in the Bible, although there is some later literature about her that's not in the Bible. The story of Abraham and his descendants covers roughly 300 years, roughly 1950 to 1650. BC? Yeah. 1950. Not rock and roll. Okay, yeah. But shortly, around 2000 BC, which is the late Bronze.
Having known several missionaries who go to very primitive areas, mm-hmm. and also some Wycliffe Bible translators.
Who go everywhere, yeah.
Think about our Bible, because they apparently study Wycliffe people get into some very primitive places and that don't have precedence. And you have to wonder what their thoughts are and how they apply the Christian principles.
Well, and I've known some Wycliffe Bible translators. I actually worked with some at one point. It's interesting because when you translate the Bible into another culture, you cannot translate it literally. It will make no sense to them. So even their worldview, as what does God mean in their culture? What is the spiritual within their culture? What is sin in their culture? And they have to reframe that. Yeah, yeah. It's a big issue. So, but roughly 300 years, like... In terms of the time frame, if you look at about 2000 BC, the time that we're in, this is considered late bronze, early iron. I forget the number, if it's iron one is first or iron three, but and that's going to shift depending on geographically where you are as to where things. Yeah. Yeah. Abraham is normally put in late bronze, roughly the transition into the Iron Age. And then the biblical narrative is pretty much within the Iron Age, iron one, iron two, iron three kind of thing. Now, you're still using bronze even in the Iron Age, but it's available. Yeah. It's been kind of created. Okay. Again, international. They're literally all over the map, literally. Look at this. It narrates the story of how God calls Abraham from where? Ur. Where is Ur? Some of our Iraq people were there. Basra in Iraq, Ur of the Chaldees. The ziggurat is still out there. Some of our guys climbed it and took pictures. So Babylon, they began to move in and out, and it's just, they're all over the Middle East. This is interesting. This is where they are in Genesis. They're in Babylon, Assyria, Canaan, and Egypt. They're all over the map, which raises the word that's used to describe God's people at this point. We're even in this section given the reason why did God do creation 3.0? What was it that did not work about 1.0 and 2.0? Why call Abraham and his family? What's God up to? And God says this, they're called to be a blessing to the other nations. By the way, this is repeated three times in Genesis. Remember Hebraic repetition? We don't say good, better, best. We say good, 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 good. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord. So if you repeat something three times, God is saying, listen up. Pay attention. You are called to be a blessing to other nations. Does Abraham exist for himself? Are we still struggling with that issue? Okay. Major, major biblical issue. Again, there's a biblical narrative. God calls Abraham and the descendants. And at the very center is God does not call us as Christians as a privilege. It is a responsibility. Okay. Anybody seen that sign over there by the practice field at SMU? It is not a privilege to play or coach for SMU. Anybody seen that? Driving that little fence on the far side, look on the left. It is not a privilege to play or coach for SMU. It is a responsibility. Okay? Same kind of message there. I don't know who put that up there, but I love it. Okay? We then tell the story of Abraham and his children. They are described as Hebrews. Anybody remember what Hebrew means? Wanderer. Babylon, Syria, Canaan, Egypt, all over the map, because that's what they are. They're wanderers. In the course of the biblical narrative, their name is going to change three times. It's going to reflect their situation, their identity. They're going to be wanderers. Later, they're going to settle in the land of Israel, and they will become Israelites. Then they're going to be taken into exile, and of the 12 tribes, there's only one tribe left, Judah, and they're going to come back as Jews. And it's interesting because in those books, mostly in the Apocrypha, it's not ethnic, it's not geographic, it is religious identity. Jews are not tied to a particular place, culture, or race. What are they tied to? They're tied to their faith in God. So you'll see that through the Old Testament. They wind up in Egypt, first welcome to flourish for 400 years, down to about 1250. That is the Exodus 1:1. You know, just real quickly, you just get 400 years done. A new Pharaoh arises who knew not Joseph. That's the old King James Version. They're oppressed. They're persecuted. By the way, they better get used to that because that's going to happen a lot. The Jews cry out for God to deliver them. The story of the deliverance is going to take four books to tell. It is that central. Bob? In Ur, yeah. Only get so much in 2 hours, Bob. There's a lot that's going to get ignored. But treetops, we're just clipping the treetops here. Okay, yeah. Take disciple Bible study, okay, and get in there. Okay, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Why did I put Deuteronomy in red? Because it repeats the other. The story is told in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, which flows directly into Joshua and Judges. Deuteronomy is literally, in Latin, second telling from a different perspective. The Exodus is going to take approximately 50 years. Those Jews are so directionally challenged. You can walk it, folks, in 2 weeks. Try it. You can walk it in 2 weeks. People do that, okay? Focuses on narrative. Spared, the child is spared. He raised in the house of Pharaoh. Kills the Egyptian. Protecting Hebrew. Flees Egypt, travels to the land of Midian. Nobody's quite sure where Midian is, but we think it's over there, probably in southern Saudi Arabia. There in a foreign land, Moses has an encounter with the God at the burning bush. God is revealed as the God who is. Yahweh is the Hebrew to be verb. God is. Translated, remember, I am? I am that is I am. Problem is, that's not the translation. The Y is the future tense of the verb. So it is not I am, it is I will be. In the ancient world, if you knew a name, you had control. So Jewish rabbis say there's a good chance Moses was trying to get leverage on God, and basically God says, mind your own business. I will be who I will be. But God is existence. People love that. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Sinai, which turns out is not Midian, okay? God has heard the cry of the Hebrews. God has seen their suffering. It's repeated 3 times. Now God sends Moses back to them. Moses has the record for being the most reluctant person God ever called. 35 perfectly good reasons that God could not use him. Slow speech, can't talk, my brother's better, give me a stick, you know, all those kinds of things. He returns to Egypt, plagues. They leave. 10th plague is, of course, the Passover. They leave Egypt for Sinai. They're saved at the Reed Sea, not the Red Sea. That is a mistranslation in the Greek. Remember, if you've ever been to Rome and there's that church where Moses has, by Michelangelo, has the horns. It's a mistranslation, another mistranslation. It's the Reed Sea. Along the way, God is depicted as present with them, pillar of cloud by day, pillar of cloud by night. What is that? Who's with them? Who is leading them? God cares for them. We have manna, we have quail and water. By the way, manna and quail still occur naturally over there. Manna is the secretion of an insect early in the morning, and you can still get it there. The Bedouins still eat it, and quail still drop out of the sky in certain times of migration stuff. Mount Sinai, God and the Hebrews make a covenant. Children of Abraham are given a code to live by. The code is religious and moral, ethical, symbolized by 2 tablets. How many do we have? The old joke is there was 3, but Moses dropped 1. Okay. Bad news is adultery's still in. Sorry about that. Okay. This is the code, symbolized 2 commandments. By the way, Jesus summarizes the law. What's the greatest commandment? Jesus says love, tablet 1, and love, tablet 2. God's presence, Hebrews, similar, we'll get into that in a lot more detail later. God's presence is now symbolized not by the pillar of cloud, by pillar of fire, but we have the tabernacle. It's basically a tent, traveling temple. We have in that the Ark of the Covenant. It's going to go wherever the people goes. The narrative then resumes, and they've been camped at Sinai for a book and a half. And so, in the middle of Numbers, we resume, and they now travel to Canaan. And by the way, they get there quickly. Doesn't take 40 years. They get there very quickly. The problem is, when they get there, they get scared. Because there's giants. Remember those giants we were worried about later? There's giants in the land. And so we're not going to go in there kind of thing. That's right. No, that's we're not. Now we know we're not is. Yeah, okay. They're forced to remain in the wilderness for 47 years until the new generation. And they're not wandering. According to the Bible, they spend 38 of those years at Kadesh Barnea, which is still there. It's an oasis. So they're not wandering all the time. But the big point is, they're not allowed to go in because they balked. That generation has to go. Another generation will come. Generation passes. New leader Joshua. Moses has to stay up on the mountain. He's not allowed to get in. He just looks over. He leads the Hebrews and the Canaanite there. And then we have this wonderful idea in Joshua. Battle of Jericho. The battle of Ai. It just looks like the Jews cannot lose. They just wipe the real estate, conquer everything. Well, that's the book of Joshua. Later, as we get into some of the other books, Judges and 1 Samuel, if they conquered everybody, why are they having so much trouble later with the people of the land? And why is Jerusalem not taken until centuries later when David takes it? Well, they didn't take everything. They took some of it. Mostly they took the highlands. With the settlement, 1200 BCE, the term Hebrews begins to fade. We have a new term that's going to be used for the people. They're going to be referred to, and it's not clean. There's some overlap, but they're called the children of Israel. They are citizens of the land of Israel. They are Israelites, and that's the language. That story is going to last for now 800 years. They're going to be in the land. It's told in the two stories, Deuteronomic and Chronicler. Each has a different perspective. We begin with the 200 years under the book of Judges. Again, this is a very depressing period. During this time, they're fighting with all those people that Joshua said we conquered. Well, we didn't quite do it because we're still struggling with them. Judges are not legal figures. They are military deliverers raised up by God, and they are men and women, right? Not just men. Can you think of a woman? Deborah. Okay. And we have books like Judith and books like Esther in the Jewish tradition. We have a lot of very strong women. The book of Judges, there's a hopeless cycle. They're trapped in for 2 centuries. Here's the cycle. You're probably familiar with it. People forget God. God hands them over to their enemies. They cry out to God for deliverance. God sends a judge to deliver them. As long as the judge is alive, they do well. But guess what? We have memory issues. We forget. And what happens? Okay. That little short book, the cycle repeats itself 12 times. And it's just a downward spiral. And it winds up with the story of Samson, okay, at the end. Israel descends into chaos. Period of Judges ends with them crying for a king, as other nations have. Another narrative over there in the Deuteronomic history says that's not a good idea because God should be our king. 1 Samuel, we tell the story of Samuel, who's the last judge, the first prophet. He anoints Saul first as king. Saul is a disappointment. He is everything people want. The Bible said he literally is head and shoulders above everybody. If you want a military deliverer, you just want, yeah. You know, Mr. Atlas there, he's big, he's handsome, he's strong, but he's got issues. He's got issues. He's not what God wants. Woven in this, we got the story of this young boy, David. He's going to go on to become Israel's greatest king. He's deeply flawed. Would you say he's deeply flawed? He's deeply flawed. He's a lot like Israel. He's deeply flawed, but he's a person of great faith. And when he's confronted, he confesses. Succeeded by his son Solomon. Solomon builds the temple, the settlement, the kingship, the building of the temple. An era ends, an era begins. We're now in the land. We're not nomads. We are a nation. Like every other nation, we are the nation of Israel. This is the period known as the United Kingdom. It only lasts 80 years. And the Jews still look back on this as the great shining time of their history. And people long for the restoration of David. And since David is a anointed, and the word for anoint is Messiah, we begin to get hopes for the Messiah would become another David. Solomon also flawed, lots of excesses, open to other gods, you know, a lot going on. We're going to end right in this section, the death of Solomon. The kingdom divides into 2 unequal parts. We got Israel in the north, we got Judah in the south. Israel in the north is the green, it's the dominant. If you've been there, where is all the water and the crops in the north? What do you have in the south? As an old southern bishop said, not much. Okay. Matter of fact, I blocked out the Negev because that's just desert. Okay. Two nations exist side by side for 200 years. At times they war with each other. And in 722, we're going to stop here. Exactly 200 years after they split, there's a new power rises called Assyria. And we're going to have our first Jews kind of go into exile. Okay. Are you okay with this? You enjoying it? Okay. Even though it's not Luther? Okay.